Welcome everyone to the to this debate organised by Darwinist LSE. When Helena Cronin asked me to chair this debate, I was at the same time flattered and rather frightened. After all, everyone's heard of the science wars, and the daftest place to be in a war is right in the middle of the warring parties. But I returned earlier today from Munich, or was it Paris, or maybe it was the LSE Centre for Philosophy of Natural and Social Sciences across the road. It's hard to tell with all this globalisation. And I have here an agreement that guarantees peace in our time. Even on a brief acquaintance with our two distinguished speakers today, I fear that any of you come expecting fireworks and hostilities may be disappointed. On the other hand, those of you who come expecting a sharp intellectual discussion of the arguments about the epistemological credentials of science and about how to study science properly, arguments developed from two interestingly different points of view, just how different we'll no doubt discover, you, I'm equally confident, will not be disappointed. After all, as a celebrated opponent of Chamberlain once said, rather in conflict with his opposition to Chamberlain, George Orr is better than War War. Presumably he meant usually George Orr is better than War War, and I'm confident this is one of the occasions. I take it that aside from pointing out that it's not a good idea for an author to try to bamboozle people in the social sciences with patently irrelevant references to quantum mechanics, chaos theory, and Gödel's theorem, especially when they patently don't understand those technical matters themselves, I take it that aside from that, what's really at issue in the so-called science wars is the extent to which social considerations play a role in the development of science. No one, of course, asserts that they play no role, compared to the extent to which science is not like other human social products, because epistemically special, because governed by purely intellectual reasons in the form of logic, a few simple methodological principles, and of course, and above all, empirical results. I take it that no one really asserts that these latter play no role either, though some social constructivists have been interpreted as asserting just that. But I look forward to finding out today, amongst other things, just how far apart in this respect our two speakers are. There are two conventions in academic life that have always puzzled me. One is that you're obliged to say in the preface to your books that the people you've thanked for critical comments on earlier drafts are not responsible for any remaining mistakes, even though no one in their right mind would ever dream they were. And the other convention is that a chairman must say that celebrated speakers need no introduction and then go on and give them one. Well, I'm just a boring old conventionalist, so let me introduce to you our two speakers tonight, neither of whom, of course, needs an introduction from me. Alan Sokol is Professor of Physics at New York University with an international reputation in the areas of quantum field theory and statistical mechanics. He's also the author of a certain paper in the Cultural Studies magazine Social Text, which seems to have drawn just a modicum of interest and attention, and also, of course, of the book written jointly with Alain Brickmont, who I'm glad to say is also in the
Jean
audience.
Jean,
I don't know why I've written Alain. Jean Brickmont, and just a few days ago published in English, Intellectual Impostures. Bruno Latour is professor at the École Nationale Supérieure des Mines in Paris. He's done influential work in the sociology or anthropology of science and in history of science, notably his book with Steve Woolgar, Laboratory Life, the book The Pasteurization of France, and he has another book also published by Harvard University Press, Pandora's Hope, Essays in the Reality of Science Studies, that's due out, I believe, very shortly. The format for the meeting will be that each of our speakers will have 20 minutes in which to address us. Each will then have the chance to respond very briefly, I think, and then the discussion will be open to an unusually distinguished floor until we close at around 8 o'clock. So first, Alan Sokol, who will speak under the title Science Studies, a Moderate Realist View.
Okay, I think we have two issues on the table tonight for discussion. One is science, its methodology, and the status of the knowledge that it produces. And the other is science studies, its methodology, and the status of the knowledge that it produces. Now, before we can try to answer the question, can science be studied scientifically, I think we first have to clarify what we mean by science and what is meant by studying something scientifically. First of all, the word science has at least four distinct senses which are crucial to distinguish. It can denote a methodology aiming at a rational understanding of the natural and social world. It can denote a body of accepted knowledge in some given field at some given time. It can denote a social community of scientists with its particular mores, institutions, and links to the larger society. And finally, it can denote applied science and technology. Now, obviously, all these aspects are related, but they're not identical, and it's important to be clear which aspects we're discussing. I want to discuss briefly the first aspect, namely the methodology of science. Now, I certainly don't intend to solve all the problems of the philosophy of science in 20 minutes, but it does seem relevant to sketch, at least roughly, what I think it means to study something scientifically and what is the status of the knowledge produced. Now, first, we have to dispose of some red herrings, some general philosophical arguments that are sometimes used to undercut scientific knowledge, but which in fact undercut all knowledge. Solipsism and radical skepticism, for example. They're irrefutable. If someone denies that there exists a world outside his mind, or admits that there exists an external world but denies the possibility of obtaining any reasonably reliable knowledge of that world, there's no way for me to convince him otherwise. But I've never met a sincere solipsist or radical skeptic, and I doubt that any exist. At a Darwin at LSE program, I think I should observe there's an obvious Darwinian explanation for that. Solipsism and radical skepticism, if applied in practice, can be harmful to your health and especially to your reproductive success. Now, the key point here is that radical skepticism holds water only if it's applied consistently to all our knowledge, not just to scientific knowledge. After all, even the most commonplace knowledge in our everyday lives, there's a glass of water over there on the table, depends entirely on the assumption that our sense perceptions don't systematically mislead us and that they really are produced by external objects that in some way or other resemble those perceptions. So it follows that whatever science is about, it is not about certainty, for there's no certainty in any of our empirical knowledge. Nor is this some novel insight due to our science studies friends. It's been a commonplace among philosophers and scientists for at least two centuries since Hume. So what is the scientific method then? And I put that in quotation marks because it's not so well defined. In my view, it's nothing more or less than the rational attitude toward investigating any empirical question. Historians, detectives, and plumbers use the same basic methods of induction, deduction, and assessment of evidence as do physicists or biochemists. Modern science has learned how to carry out these operations in a more careful and systematic way by using controls and statistical tests, insisting on replication, and so forth. Moreover, scientific measurements are often much more precise than everyday observations. They allow us to discover previously unknown phenomena, and scientific results often conflict with common sense. But the conflict is at the level of conclusions, not the basic approach. Now, contrary to some philosophers of the early 20th century, I don't think there's much hope for completely codifying the scientific method. We're not going to be able to produce an instruction manual telling us when we should abandon an old theory or accept a new one. Science is too complicated for that. But there's not much hope for codifying everyday rationality either. And the fact that reasonable people can disagree about the import of evidence, especially when that evidence is sparse and incomplete, doesn't mean that evidence is irrelevant or that the assessment of evidence is purely subjective. So what is the status of scientific knowledge? Roughly the same, I think, as the status of any other empirical knowledge. Some of it is weakly supported by evidence, and so should be considered speculative until more definitive evidence becomes available. Other parts are strongly supported by a vast web of interlocking evidence from different fields, and so should be accorded a high likelihood of being at least approximate truths. Most, though not all, frontier science falls in the former category, and most, though not all, well-established science falls in the latter. Now, all of this is, of course, so banal that it's embarrassing having to make it explicit. It's certainly, there's nothing novel in what I've just said. And I would hardly bother, except that some trendy sectors of the sociology of science seem to want to call into question the objective validity of scientific knowledge, or, more often, to obfuscate it with ambiguous verbiage. Okay, and I'll give some examples of that maybe in the discussion period. Okay, so much for science. What then of our second subject, science studies? First, I want to fend off the accusation that I'm an arrogant physicist who rejects all sociological intrusion on our turf. And I want to lay out some positive things that I think social studies of science can accomplish. First of all, science is a human endeavor. So like any other human endeavor, it merits being subjected to rigorous social analysis. Which research problems count as important? How research funds are distributed? Who gets prestige and power? What role scientific expertise plays in public policy debates? In what form scientific knowledge becomes embodied in technology, and above all, for whose benefit? All these issues are strongly affected by political, economic, and to some extent ideological considerations, as well as by the internal logic of scientific inquiry. So they're fruitful subjects for empirical study by historians, sociologists, political scientists, and economists. Second, at a more subtle level, even the content of scientific debate, what types of theories can be conceived and entertained, what criteria are to be used for deciding between competing theories, all this is constrained in part by prevailing attitudes of mind, which in turn arise in part from deep-seated historical factors. So it's the task of historians and sociologists of science to sort out, in each specific instance, the roles played by so-called external and internal factors in determining the course of scientific development. Third, there's nothing wrong with research informed by a political commitment, as long as that commitment doesn't blind the researcher to inconvenient facts. So there's a long and honorable tradition of socio-political critique of misguided scientific theories. For example, anti-racist critiques of anthropological pseudoscience and eugenics, and feminist critiques of psychology and parts of medicine and biology. Now, these critiques, or at least the best of them, typically follow a standard pattern. First one shows, using conventional scientific arguments, why the research in question is flawed according to the ordinary canons of good science. Then, and only then, one attempts to explain how the researcher's social prejudices, which may well have been unconscious, led them to violate these canons. Now, of course, each such critique has to stand or fall on its own merits. Having good political intentions doesn't guarantee that one's analysis will constitute good science, good sociology, or good history. But I do think that this general two-step approach is sound, and empirical studies of this kind, if conducted with due intellectual rigor, could shed useful light under the social conditions under which good science is fostered or hindered. And here, good science, I emphasize, is defined normatively as the search for truths, or at least approximate truths, about the world. Now, I don't want to claim that these three points exhaust the field of fruitful inquiry for historians and sociologists of science, but they certainly do lay out a big and important area. And yet, some sociologists and literary intellectuals over the past two decades have become more ambitious. Roughly speaking, they want to attack the normative conception of scientific inquiry as a search for truths or approximate truths about the world. They want to see science as just another social practice which produces narrations or myths or discourses that contain no more truth than those produced by other social practices. Now, of course, like all brief summaries, this one is an oversimplification. And in any case, there is no canonical doctrine in the new sociology of science, just a bewildering variety of individuals and schools. More importantly, the task of summarization is here made more difficult by the fact that this literature is often ambiguous in crucial ways about its most fundamental claims. Still, I think most scientists and philosophers of science would be astonished to learn that, quote, the natural world has a small or non-existent role in the construction of scientific knowledge, as prominent sociologist of science Harry Collins has claimed, or that, quote, reality is the consequence rather than the cause of the so-called social construction of facts, as Bruno Latour and Steve Woolgar have asserted. Now, I certainly don't intend to tell sociologists how they should study science and scientists, but I do have a few suggestions about how not to do so. In particular, I'm critical of the so-called strong program in the sociology of science, which seeks causal explanations of scientists' beliefs and insists that true and false beliefs, rational and irrational beliefs, should be explained symmetrically. That's the key word in the strong program, symmetrically. Now, in part, this is a salutary reaction against an older tradition in the history of science that explained errors sociologically, but thought that a theory's correctness was sufficient explanation for why it came to be accepted. Now, obviously, that won't do. and one positive development in the history of science over the last 40 years has been to reach a much more sophisticated understanding of the process that leads to acceptance or rejection of a theory. But I don't think that the demand for symmetrical explanation will hold water. Suppose, for example, that you want to give a causal account of why the European scientific community became convinced of the truth of Newtonian mechanics sometime between 1700 and 1750. Now, undoubtedly, a variety of historical, sociological, political, and theological factors must play some part in this explanation. For example, you have to explain why Newtonian mechanics was accepted relatively quickly in England and more slowly in France. But certainly some part of the explanation, and I think a rather important part, must be that people had good evidence that the planets and comets really do move to a high degree of approximation, although not exactly, as predicted by Newtonian mechanics. Now, suppose, by contrast, that you want to give a causal account of why some people believe in astrology. Then it's at least conceivable that you might succeed in giving a purely sociological account of those beliefs without ever invoking the good evidence supporting them, simply because there is no such evidence. On the other hand, if you happen to believe wrongly that astrology is well supported by evidence, then this factor should presumably enter into what you regard as an adequate causal account of the belief in astrology. So the supporters of the strong program face a dilemma. They could, if they choose, adhere systematically to a radical philosophical skepticism or relativism, as some of their writings suggest, but in that case it's unclear why or how they would seek to build a scientific sociology or to give a causal explanation of anything. Alternatively, they could choose to adopt only the methodological relativism contained in the symmetry principle. But this position is untenable if one abandons philosophical relativism because it ignores an essential element of the desired explanation, namely the evidence for or against the theories in question. If one admits that, at least in some cases, there can be evidence for or against propositions and that beliefs can be influenced by evidence, then it's manifestly invalid to seek a purely social explanation of beliefs without first evaluating the evidence. Now, of course, it's not always easy to evaluate the evidence. Professional scientists themselves constantly disagree. But there's no other way. This problem is particularly acute for those sociologists who aspire to study science in action, that is, science at the research front. How do they distinguish between beliefs that are held for purely sociological reasons, which, after all, is perfectly possible, scientists are not immune to fads, and those that are held for valid empirical reasons? Well, it seems obvious that to attempt such a judgment, you have to know the science in detail, not just the sociology. Now, that's by no means impossible. Sociologists could collaborate with scientists, or they might have prior professional training in the fields they're studying. But at least some prominent sociologists of science deny the need for such knowledge. For example, Steve Fuller, who I guess is here tonight in the audience, so maybe he can explain himself, claims that, he doesn't have to, but he can if he wants. I didn't know he was going to be here. Steve Fuller claims that the goal of science studies is, quote, to employ methods that enable sociologists to fathom both the inner workings and the outer character of science without having to be expert in the fields they study. And even sociologists who don't go that far will often claim that, not being scientists, they're not obliged to take sides in the scientific controversies they're studying. But that just won't hold water if the goal is to understand not just social relations among scientists and how they dress and so on, but to understand why a scientific controversy was resolved in the way it was. It's impossible to interpret adequately the relative role played by rational and cognitive factors versus fashion, prestige, and economic self-interest without making at least some judgment of the underlying scientific issues. Okay, one last point about science studies. Some recent work in the history and sociology of science seeks to deny the objective validity of scientific knowledge by claiming the changes of paradigm, in Kuhn's sense, are due principally to non-empirical factors, and that once accepted, they condition our perception of the world to such an extent that they can only be confirmed by our subsequent observations. Now, I think that's a misreading of the history of science, but most importantly, I want to stress that this view is self-undermining. Research in history, and in particular in the history of science, employs methods that are not radically different from those used in the natural sciences. Studying documents, drawing the most rational inferences, making inductions based on the available data, and so forth. If arguments of this type in physics or biology didn't allow us to arrive at reasonably reliable conclusions, what reason would there be to trust them in history? Why speak in a realist mode about historical categories, such as paradigms, if it's an illusion to speak in a realist mode about scientific concepts, which in fact are much more precisely defined, such as electrons or DNA? Now, in fact, one can go further. It's natural to introduce a hierarchy in our beliefs, in the degree of credence accorded to different theories, depending on the quantity and quality of the evidence supporting them. Every scientist, in fact, every human being, rightly proceeds in this way. So we accord a higher subjective probability, a higher likelihood, to the best established theories, for example, the evolution of species or the existence of atoms, and a lower subjective probability to more speculative theories, such as detailed theories of quantum gravity or the origin of life. And the same reasoning applies when comparing theories in natural science with those in history or sociology. For example, the evidence of the existence of atoms is vastly stronger than anything Kuhn could put forward in the support of his historical theories. This doesn't mean, of course, that physicists are more clever than historians or that they use better methods, but simply that they deal with less complex problems involving a smaller number of variables which, moreover, are easier to measure and to control. It's impossible to avoid introducing such a hierarchy in our beliefs, and this hierarchy implies that there's no argument based on history or sociology that could support a blanket challenge to the reliability of scientific results. So, returning to the question, can science be studied scientifically, my answer is going to be a cop-out. My answer is that remains to be seen. We'll just have to see what the sociologists come up with and evaluate it. But one thing I think is rather certain. Unless one grants that atoms, cells, and stars can be studied scientifically, and that the knowledge thereby obtained is reasonably reliable, then there's no hope for the scientific study of those vastly more complicated entities that we call scientists. Thank you. No.
Well, thank you very much. And now Bruno Latour will speak under the title The Historical Shift from Science to Research.
Thank you very much. I'm not completely sure how much we disagree, and we are going to explore that in just a few minutes. My point, I will make three different points. The first one is exactly the end of Alan's talk, that is, science studies business as usual. There is nothing of great interest and nothing very new in the extension of scientific practice to science itself. The second point, of course, would be completely disingenuous if I was maintaining only this argument. And I agree that it has opened some Pandora's hope is what I do, not Pandora's box, and a sort of great confusion into the uncertainties between who is studying whom and what sort of objectivity is. But I think the reason why it had so much impact, and this meeting today is a good indication of that, is also because there is a big shift, in my view, in the general public from what I would call science to research. And finally, I just offer an alternative to the philosophy of science, so that scientists have what in the commerce or business is called product differentiation. So the question is now, the first question is, can we study science? And we had a nice summary of that, so I'll go very quickly. The answer is, of course, no, except the most superficial aspect, if they are of interest to the, not great interest to the scientist, letting aside the question of rational reconstruction, which is a very important and tradition, but which is not really about the practice of science. And the other solution, which is my line in that aspect, is yes. And the reason why I say yes, because if you answer no, it means that there is no second opinion on the scientific practice. That is, science is its own discourse. It's its own study. It's its own arbiter. And that is precisely where I think I still disagree with Alan on this question. Should we reopen a second discussion once science has been established? And the reason why I think it's possible and necessary is because it is an extension of a scientific outlook to every single other element. I mean, if we can study the descent of man, to use a Darwin case, we can study also the production of relativity theory of the highest possible virtue. There's no transcendence in science which would escape normal, materialist, reductionist, and yet, yes, causal explanation. And I think if there is a plea to the contrary and Alan didn't do it, it would need a lot of work in order to say, well, everything is studyable but science, but fortunately this is not Alan's point. Now, of course, the question more difficult is who and how should we study it and who should study it? And I don't think we are going to get into the discussion, and Alan steered away from that impossible choice between pure ignorant who would be allowed to get into anything they know, they don't know, and make a study of it. That is complete ignorance. The other position will be completely absurd, and that would be the one that would reserve the study of science to the scientists themselves. And of course, it would be self-defeating. We are in a school here, School of Economics. It would be like saying, well, economics will be judged and studied by workers and managers and not by economists. I mean, I don't think the economists in this school would like that very much. So in all of the different fields of social sciences, and of course it's true also in natural sciences, you don't need to be a rat to study rats, and you don't need to be a frog to study frogs. So it's always distance and familiarity which define what it is to study one thing. So this is complete science studies, complete common sense on that respect. But it has one important different features from the rest of the social sciences, and tonight we have a nice exemplification of that. We talk and we study people and object of study who talk back, which is not always the case with rats and frogs. And that's one of the reasons of a productivity, energy, and also difficulty of science studies, of course. And it's very rare to have a field of science, of social science, which doesn't study up and down, but which studies people who are not exactly equal, but at least try to be. Now, how should we study? Science is now a whole gamut of discipline, and of course it would be completely wrong to think it's only sociology. There are lots of things, bibliometry, science policy, economics, evolutionary theory, cognitive science. There's a whole range of science, of social sciences and humanity, which are addressing the what it is to study sciences. And I don't think, Alan didn't talk about that, but we would disagree that like all good well-equipped laboratory, we should have all the instruments around in order to coordinate attention on what is the scientific practice. But where I think I disagree with Alan is in the list of things to be studied. He tried to make a hierarchy. I disagree somehow. I don't show you I disagree, but I think I disagree with a hierarchy, because in this, what we are interested in science studies is five rather different type of subject which are related, and the hierarchy of which is quite difficult. The first one is the whole mobilization, the notion of instrument, the mobilization of data, the whole material world of producing information, which is a large part of science studies. The second one is quite unrelated but necessary to scientific practice, and that's the autonomization of a discipline, how to produce colleagues, how to write, to produce reviews and institutions, journals, PhD students, and so on. Autonomizing the discipline is a very different skill. But the third one is also very different again, and contradictory to the other one. The second one is to make autonomy. The second one, on the contrary, is to produce heteronomy, to produce, to interest a large community of people to the production of science, what could be called alliances with military, with the health, with the state, and so on. And a large part of science studies has been also about that as well. The fourth one, which is more and more important, as I will see, we'll show in a minute, is what could be called representation or public relation of science, which is all what the general public does with these sciences, be it then primatology, Darwinism, or astronomy or physics. There is a large constituency behind the sciences, which are part of a scientific practice because they get the results, produce some of the ideology back, and have to be counted in an accurate description of scientific practice. And the fifth one, the cognitive, so-called cognitive dimension, which he studied, and as Alan recognized, it is one of the very important aspects of the studies of the science studies, historians of science and sociologists. But it's not a core which would be isolated from the rest. It's the center of a large network, a large knot of interest, which have to be connected. So when we study the cognitive content, we are not studying an isolated core, but on the contrary, a highly connected center, which has to be taken into account, but which should not be given too much weight. And that's a very important point, because it means that the argument, which is the self-contradiction, on which I'm not sure I understand, I will have a question to ask to Alan in a minute, what I would call first-order objectivity is the science, and second-order objectivity is the studies of science. And I think we agree on that, I'm not sure, but the impossible solution would be a study of science, second-order objectivity, which would be stronger than the first-order objectivity. Sociology of science would be stronger than physics. I mean, I don't think anyone said that. It would be completely absurd. But I don't think the other one, which is on the bottom there, that is the first-order objectivity and the second-order objectivity are sort of drawn into a black hole of self-deconstruction, exist either. And I sort of think we agree, or we might agree at the end of the discussion, I don't know, but the most normal solution is this one, that is first-order objectivity and second-order objectivity are in the same boat. And it's not a superiority or an inferiority, they are both put at risk, which is, I think, one very simple solution to the problem. Now, it is a solution only if we get away from the red herring, Alan used this word, of social construction, except he said it's a red herring, but use the notion of mere social explanation constantly. So, I need to make one transparency to make one clear again, that the idea of a social explanation of science is a red herring. It's a red herring because the choice between either a mere social explanation or something which will avow or confess the solid objectivity of outside fact is actually never made. So this is a red herring because it is an artifact. And a large part of science studies, at least the part which I'm interested in doing, is trying to figure out why do we have this choice, and only that choice, between mere social construction on one hand and the full-blown objectivity on the other one. And that's why I disagree, I think, with Alan on that, because his plea is for moderate realism, which is like being moderately pregnant. It seems to me quite difficult to be. And if we start to talk about realism, we have to be full-blown realism. And I think one way to portray our disagreement, as far as I could understand them, is to use this little Macintosh diagram, which is, what doesn't hold water, to use one of the favorite Alan's expressions, is this very difficult position of having a cut between society and nature with two completely unexplainable break. That is the one that produces objectivity by getting out or breaking from the shackles of social order, subjectivity, and so on. And the second one, which I represented here, and the second one, which is coming back equipped with the laws of nature, which are not exactly uncontrovertible, but at least very well assured, and put or use them in order to put some social, to put order inside the society. My solution, which I would call full-blown realism, a realistic pictures of science, is slightly different from Alan, except it's almost the same, but for the little point here. I'm interested in something which is very simple. Yes, there is outside reality. Yes, science has a privileged access to outside reality. If by outside we mean what numbers of new entities, like prions, if we want to take the nice example of a recent search, or gene, or black holes, which are now made part of our collective life. So if we want to say the big problem is objectivity on the one side and mere social construction on the other one, I say, no, this is not my problem. That never interests me for 1 minute. If we now mean what it is to build a collective with new entities which were not part of a collective in time, 1 week, 1 year, 1 century ago, yes, that's the problem of science study. And it's a very important one, which is what sort of collective is thus built. Now, why should I, and I'll go very quickly on that, why should scientists study, pay any attention to the study of science? The answer is they should not. Please let us do our work. Don't pay attention. We were very happy before. You have no reason to study that. And it's absolutely... It's only when you are sick that you need to go to the gastroenterologist, for instance. If your intestine is okay, fine. Don't read us. Do your work. Now, if there is a crisis, then it might be interesting to know how the scientific production is done from outside. And being a scientist gives absolutely no idea of how science is made, exactly like the fact of having an intestine. It doesn't give you any sort of privileged insight on how your bowels function. Now, the question is, are we in a state of crisis? And that's where I'll get to my last point. I think we are. And that's why this debate is interesting. The very simple way of portraying the crisis is in the following way. In the trope, in the way of Alan, the way he presented this argument, it's a very nice cut between politics on the one hand, mere social construction, and science and objectivity. This word, we have lost it. The word in which the clear separation between science and politics were clearly possible and desirable. We are entering in a word which I think is rather different, which I call research and not science, which is the uncertainty on the ability of a scientist to bring unity of the outside reality inside public discussion. In other words, before, in the time of science with a capital S, we could hope that the more science you get, the less political disorder and political dispute you will get. Now, just to caricature the opposition, when you add science to a political controversy, you add fuel to a fire. You add more controversy, or at least another type of controversy, to the first one. So the question of recognizing the outside reality of science, which is of course recognized, Alan, I recognize, I swear, I pledge I recognize it, does not solve our problem. Our problem is how do we do when we have a conflict about reality? And that's where the key difference in this science war, although I don't like the word more, and that's what could be called the generalization of science policy. Every one of us now has to do some science policy, which is a very nice term, and we have to decide between degenerative research program, to use Lakatos expression, and progressive one. Think of what the Swiss did 2 weeks ago. They voted, which is a nightmare, of course, for the scientist. They voted, they could have voted against, they voted for, finally, but they decided to vote for or against genetic engineering. I mean, that's a quite different research policy. It's not accepting the science as it is. It was voting on the desirability of the science. This is a new situation in which the scientists have to learn. And so that I'm not accused, as I'm often are by Alan, to hedge out of the issue, the question really is this, and it boils down to this transparency, and that's the thing which I really like to discuss with you. In the Alan's position, the work of rationality is finished. That is, we know there is one nature, and there are multiple cultures which should be stay in check. That is, they should be only about private beliefs. They should not intrude on what the world is like. And that's the difference. That's why accusing someone of relativism is like accusing him of zoophilia or some horrible sin. And even zoophiliac, I'm sure, are their defenders, which is not the case with relativists. And what the opposing position is not multiculturalism or relativism of the sort everything is equal, as we just heard, science is just one, the religion and astrology are all equal. This is not absolutely not the debate. The debate is this one. Is the work of rationality, that is achieving what it is to live in a common world, finished or not? If you say yes, it's finished, because we know what the one world is, it's the world of nature, and what is left for the multiplicity is the world of culture, then you agree with Alan, and that's a completely different line. My line is completely different. We don't know yet the work of rationality, the work of building the one world in which we can live a decent life is not finished. So you cannot unify it prematurely, and you cannot just stick to multiculturalism either. To think that this is the opposition, one world or multiple world, is, I think, not believing in rationality strongly enough. So to conclude, I think the scientists and the scientific community, which is actually not our interlocutors, right? We are just one of them. We are not very much interested, actually, in their opinion. They are just one informant among many. But if they are interested, because there is a crisis, or they recognize it that there is a crisis, by what we do, then the choice is quite simple. Either you think you can unify the world by developing science, and that's, I think, a large part of Alan's position, that is, you can unify, and at the end, cultures will start to disappear. Basically, you can unify the world under the aegis of a scientific outlook. And that's one way. The danger, of course, is that there is very little place for the general public except pedagogy. They have to learn the damn stuff and get stuck. Now, the other possibility, which I think is the one which I represent, I guess, tonight, is that scientists should participate in this generalized science policy. But the privileged access to reality that we have, that no one denies them, does not solve our problem, which is what it is to live in a common world. And the only risk, which is, there might be other risks which I downplay, but the one I see very clearly, which for me is actually not a very big risk, is the danger of abandoning a traditional philosophy of science, which only maintains the mantra of, if you don't want the full-blown objectivity of a moderate view we just heard, then it's pure social construction. I think if scientists believe they can go to the next millenary with that opposition, they are simply wrong. Thank you very much.
Okay, so now Alan has 5 minutes or so. We're actually making.
So I guess I'm supposed to comment briefly. Something very modest that Bruno said that I want to disagree with. He said, first of all, that science studies has nothing to offer scientists and nothing to fright them. And in response to the question, why should scientists pay attention to science studies, the answer is they shouldn't. Well, I disagree. I think that science studies does have quite a lot to offer scientists. Now, I want to emphasize, I don't think that the only purpose of history of science or sociology of science is to help working scientists. There are lots of other reasons. I mean, history of science is a legitimate part of the history of all human thought. But I do think that history and sociology of science can help working scientists. And I think in my talk I gave a few examples. Let me just give another one, an example of the kind of sociological work that I personally would find very valuable. And by the way, it's also an example that illustrates the flaws of the symmetry thesis of the strong program. There's an increasing shift in recent years from public financing of research to private financing, especially in the biological sciences. And in my mind, this carries grave risks. When you have research, I mean, we've always had research sponsored by entities that have a vested interest in the topic of research. That's pretty much inevitable. But now you have research sponsored by entities that have a vested interest also in a particular outcome of the research. For example, when a drug company sponsors research on a drug's effectiveness. And it seems to me that in this situation, scientific objectivity becomes more difficult to achieve. Okay, now wait a minute. What I've just said is not a theorem of sociology. It's a conjecture, right? It's a reasonable conjecture based on our intuitive understanding of how humans behave. But I think it would be valuable to subject it to more rigorous sociological study. So you could examine statistically, for example, whether a hypothesis is more likely to be supported by a scientific study when the funding comes from an entity with a vested interest in the hypothesis being true, as opposed to an entity with no vested interest or one with a vested interest in it being false. But please note that to show that objectivity is compromised, it's not sufficient to observe a correlation between funding sources and scientific results, because the causation might run in the other direction. It might be that a company with money at risk would be more likely to invest in hypotheses that they have good reason to believe are true. Rather, if you want to investigate the undermining of objectivity, you have to look for a correlation between funding sources and scientific errors. That is, ask whether a false hypothesis is more likely to be supported when the funding comes from an entity with a vested interest in it being true. And then you see that to carry out a study like this, you have to be able to try it at least to distinguish which hypotheses are probably true or probably false. And that's something which is virtually impossible to do for frontier science almost by definition, for science in action, but it could be interesting to do retrospectively. So that's one example of something where one of many examples. My list was not intended to be exhaustive. It was intended to be illustrative. I think there are many, many things that science studies does have to offer scientists. I don't think science studies has anything to frighten scientists, but it does have some things to appall scientists and philosophers of science. I quoted a few of them. I think that, Bruno is presenting a very mild view of science studies, and most of the things he said I agree with, but I think he's underplaying the extent to which many prominent people in science studies, including himself, in published writings, have taken a much more radical view of the and have talked about ambiguous things like the so-called social construction of facts. I don't want to get into some of that now, but if necessary, I can quote some of Bruno's writings to give examples. Now, he asked me what to explain what I mean by moderate realism, because I admit I don't want to be moderately pregnant. What I mean by that is moderate in the following sense. It's a subtle point that, again, I don't want to get into right now. But what I mean is, one has to be careful in attributing existence to the theoretical entities in scientific theories which we know are not final theories. So, for example, Newtonian mechanics gives an incredibly precise account of the motion of planets and terrestrial objects and many other things. And that's an objective transcultural fact. But Newtonian mechanics is objectively false. It's been superseded by quantum mechanics and general relativity, which give a better quantitative account, but have totally changed the ontology. And so we have to be aware that small quantitative changes in scientific predictions can make radical changes in the fundamental ontology. So one has to be very careful. That's what I meant by a moderate realism. A lot of the things that Bruno brought up and that he implied that we disagree on, I don't think we disagree. They were simply issues that I wasn't discussing. I want to insist on the distinction between the four different meanings of the word science that I laid out. I don't claim that there's a sharp boundary between those four any more than there's a sharp boundary between hot water and cold water, but I do think there's a difference between the methodology of science, the content of science, the social structure of the scientific community, and applied science and technology, and I want to keep them distinct. So I simply was not talking about the public policy type questions that Bruno was discussing at the end. In particular, I want to insist on the importance of the fact-value distinction, which Bruno seemed to be sloughing over. He said, first he attributed to me the statement, there is one world and multiple cultures should not intrude on what the world is like. I would revise that. Multiple cultures cannot intrude on what the world is like. It's simply impossible. No culture can change the laws of physics, whatever they are. We can have accurate or inaccurate beliefs about the laws of physics, but the laws of physics are whatever they are, independent of us. And then he said, is the work of rationality finished or not? No, the work of building one common world there's the work of building one common world in which we can build a decent life. Well, that's a question of ethics and politics and value, which I simply wasn't addressing. I was addressing the side of science as a quest for a cognitive enterprise, as a quest for knowledge about the world. I want to emphasize that that does not solve all public policy questions. Let me give the example, which is very important in the next decades for the human race, the question of global warming. Okay, the Earth's atmosphere has certain properties. We don't know what those properties are, but it has certain properties, and those properties are independent of our fears, independent of our desires, independent of our beliefs. They are what they are. And scientists are doing their best to discover those properties. It's a very complicated system, and discovering those properties is very, very difficult. And of course, in this case, it's made more difficult by the vast economic and political vested interests in particular outcomes of that study. But I think we would all agree that whatever your economic and political views, it's in your best interest to base public policy, if possible, on an accurate rather than an inaccurate understanding of how the world's climate how the Earth's climate works. Now, of course, if you have certain vested interests, it may be in your interest to have an accurate understanding yourself and then mislead other people about it. But that's obviously a political point. But what I want to emphasize is that public policy should be based, I hope, on an accurate understanding of the Earth's climate to the extent that we can achieve that. But that cognitive understanding does not resolve all the public policy questions. Even if we have in hand a perfect understanding of how the Earth's climate works, we still are going to have to make difficult decisions which involve political and ethical questions. It'll involve weighing the quality of life for the current generations with quality of life for future generations. It'll involve weighing benefits and harm to different people in different countries and in different social classes and in different occupations and so on. The science is not going to resolve these political questions, and nobody, I think, ever pretended that it would. But I do want to emphasize the importance of keeping the fact-value distinction in both directions. I don't think values should prejudice our evaluation of the facts. Regardless of what your values are, it's in your best interest to make as objective an assessment of the facts as you can. And on the other hand, I don't think facts dictate values. We're going to have to make value judgments that go beyond simply questions of scientific fact. So I think a lot of the questions that Bruno discussed were simply things that I wasn't addressing, and we may well not disagree. Although I confess I didn't understand everything that Bruno was saying. Okay.
So now, Bruno Latour. 5 minutes or so, responding to that?
I would be very brief, because I had expected this accusation, but
oh.
I think here we are in business, because the...
Sorry. I thought it was finished, that's why I went... I think here we are in business because the very important features of the argument of Alan in replying to me is the very important sharp boundary which should be maintained between facts and value in the traditional view, that is avoiding mad scientists to invade values by dictating what we should do in the name of what things are, and of course the opposite nightmarish view, which is invasion of data by ideological concern. And I don't think, I mean, I think it's a nice way to do it, and I understand why you hold it, and it's perfectly respectable, but I'm not hedging out of a dispute. I think it's possible to produce an alternative, which is the one I'm producing it here. Now, of course, whenever it's complicated, Alan just jumped a chapter, so it has some difficulty into getting the argument, and he accused me of obscurity. But he just finds on never go to the next chapter. So I'm sorry for this thing, but there's absolutely no reason why philosophy of science would be common sense. I mean, physicists are inventing lots of strange things, but when they do philosophy of science, it should be like putting your slippers when you come tonight. I mean, so fact is a very nice type, but it's badly constructed. It's badly made of two different things. The thing we are perplexed about, the new entity, the one which I agree with you, the surprising outside reality which we are not counted as members of our collective before. That's one part of fact. But with it, it makes something entirely different, which is the thing we are absolutely certain about, the thing which are taught in the textbook, the thing which are institutionalized, the absolute certainty. Why is it in the same box? I just propose to put the part of perplexity in one box and to put the other part, the certainty, in another box, and to ask two different questions. how many entities do we have to take into account in order to build our common world? That's question one. And nicely enough, a very important part of what is called value, because see, the whole trick of Alan is to say, this is just a cognitive question. We are not talking about politics here. And he very nicely misunderstood my argument about science policy as saying a public policy question after the fact have been determined. This is not what I said. This is precisely the old settlement, which is now impossible. So in the value, we have also mixing up two entirely different things. One, who should be consulted in order to maintain some sort of decision about facts. I mean, the Swiss were not asked to decide simply on public policy. They were doing research policy. That is, they were deciding what is a degenerate and what is a progressive research program. So it's pretty tough. In an example we are studying in Paris, we are studying a charity doing muscular dystrophy research. They do more molecular biology than the whole French state on public money. On charity money. And that's doing very active research policy. The people who have AIDS are doing research policy when they go to their doctors and say, well, you have not read the last thing, and here's the Lancet, which I studied carefully, and they are trying to know more than the doctors. We are all engaged. I mean, the global warming is a very nice case, and I like the Kyoto meeting because of that, because you have all this discussion of what we should do. Now, the question of fact and the question of what we should do is not nicely separated by the cut that Alan maintained. It's not that it's confused, Alan, and it's not that I'm confusing the thing. It's that there is something else. There is a successor. There is an alternative. We are not forever stuck in the old debate. And in the value thing, there is another thing, which I would call hierarchy. That is, what is more important than what? Is the American economy more important than the global Earth or not? We don't know. And that's what is this good. Sorry. I'm sorry, we know, and it's of good. So I think it will be much more interesting and much more rewarding for this discussion and for the scientific position if instead of a divide between fact and value, we were having two different questions. Question of numbers. How many entities do we have to take into account? I'm very interested in the prions, this little non-conventional protein responsible for some of Creutzfeldt-Jacob and the death of the potential death of many Brits, although that doesn't, I'm not especially pleased with that. Now, as you know, there is a whole scientific controversy around this. I mean, is there a cofactor which is added to the prion or not? This is a highly disputed thing. This makes the scientists perplexed. Perplexed scientists are fabulous. Now, it's not that they should leave to others the task of value. And I propose to cut the pie slightly differently. One question is a question of number, and the question is that of coexistence. Can we live in one common world? And if you believe, and that's my retort to the argument against multiculturalism, the argument about multiculturalism is not that a culture can modify the laws of physics. I mean, if we let this discussion go that low, it's not very interesting. The interesting discussion is the common world in which you have to restart the negotiation to convince, for instance, American creationists that they are in the same world as Stephen Jay Gould or myself or yourself, that's a much more difficult question. That is, what is the work, the rational work we should do in order to live in a common world where you have the creationists, the Islamic fanatics, where you have the ufologists, the religious people, and so on. If you say, well, if you start the discussion by saying all of those are, of course, private beliefs which have no relevance whatsoever for public, for the one common world in which we are, I think it's a bad start. And my argument is simply that let's try another argument, which is to distinguish, to repack facts and value into two different questions. How many are we? Can we live together? That would be my retort to.
It'd be interesting to give Alan another 5 minutes and then see whether Bruno has another overhead to
I have.
Oh, I knew the answer. But I'm under strict instructions now to open the floor to the discussion. And this is open the discussion to the floor, is that right? This is where I earn my free dinner and become a very strict chairman. In particular, it's very important, especially since there are so many people, although it's very difficult because there are so many people, that the person asking the question should use the roving mics. Now, I don't know, can somebody indicate to me where the roving mics are? Well, how about these poor disenfranchised people at the top? People at the top need to shout very loudly, and then I need to repeat their question, probably. Jean Bricmont, not Alan Bricmont, but Jean Bricmont is the first question.
Thank you. Unlike Alan, I disagree with many things that you say. I mean, first of all, that's a side remark, but I don't think you can use materialism to say that we have to be able to analyze anything we like. I mean, it's very strange to think that animals such as us are able to answer all the questions that they might care to ask. It's very possible that we are able to understand parts of nature, but not ourselves. That's a side remark. The main criticism that I have of your talk is that you are watering down the most extreme statement that you are making in your writing and to which we object. You see, we don't object to social studies or science per se, but we object to the symmetry principle inherent in the strong program and which is pervading the spirit of most studies of science, a big deal of studies of science. I mean, Alan gave this example about the difference between studying astrology and studying the history of Newtonian mechanics. And we have never been modern. You summarize the symmetry principle by saying you have to, if you want to account for beliefs in UFOs, then you have to verify if your explanation can be employed symmetrically for black holes. If you study parapsychology, are you able to use the same factor for psychology? If you analyze the successes of Pasteur, can you use the same term to account for his failures? And there you refer to your own work. In Science in Action, you know very well the discussion we have about the third rule of method, is that in the third rule of method, you say that since the settlement of a controversy is the cause of nature's representation, not the consequence, we can never use the outcome, nature, to explain how and why a controversy has been settled. So we leave out the fact that you seem to say that nature is the outcome of the settlement of a controversy, which seems strange to me. Let's say that what you are saying is that we can never use nature to explain why a controversy has been settled, which again seems to be completely contradictory to what Alan has been trying to explain, that either you commit yourself to the extreme position that we never ever believe anything because there is evidence that supports that belief, or else you have to explain what is special about science and why in science we have these beliefs which are not supported by evidence, or else you have to use the fact, you have to admit that, you know, the scientific beliefs are partially caused by evidence supporting them, and then you have to take this thing into account in order to explain why scientific beliefs are held. Finally, when you say that the informant, you see, well, the problem, the basic reason why sociologists, or especially if you study science in action, the basic reason I think you try to not to take into account the evidence is because it's extremely difficult to evaluate. What is the, and that's the whole crux of the problem, it's difficult to evaluate the evidence of what the scientists say in another field, including what they say about global warming, or what about evolutionary theory, or whatever. That's difficult, but that's the way things are, and we cannot avoid that problem. And it seems to me that eventually, when you say you're not interested in scientists reading what you say, it's partly, it sounds to me like an anthropologist who study a tribe and say, but I'm not interested in these people reading what I say about them. And eventually there is somebody from the tribe who comes and reads what he says, and they say, but I realize he never understood that language. And that's basically
Bruno.
That's an easy one, so I didn't prepare another head. Since you have a book, and can I ask you to do something which you should have done for 2 years, which is to read the Rule 4? Would you be honest enough to read?
No, I don't have the book.
Ah, see, that's right. So, because, so no, I don't. I forget it what it was. But I mean, I forget the exact reading. But it's quite amusing because this is always maintained in the citation, which is the either or, which is the citation about the argument of a consensus, and you never cite the Rule 4, which is the bulk of my whole work, which is the critique of social construction. I mean, that's absolutely it seems that there's no way to sink in. And the whole argument, so I think I sort of understand the trope, is to say, well, there is a radical position, which is you are a radical relativist, and when there is a public occasion, you water it down. This is your expression, right?
No, I don't
think. It's really because you are ambiguous.
But can you wait before?
I got pulled for.
Ah, very good.
You've not got the microphone, though.
The problem is that even sociologists of science, adherents of the strong program, don't understand you. You criticize us. I mean, read what Barnes, Bloor, and Henry say in Sociology of Scientific Knowledge. They say, for la tour, and they quote you, science is war. I mean, they don't quote you, they refer to you. They say, science is war, and it's a Hobbesian war of all against all, and all means are possible to obtain the desired result. And they make you into a very, very strong constructivist from which themselves they try to, you know, distance themselves. Of course, I don't agree with them either, but it seems to me that you are making a very radical statement sometimes, and then you correct them with other statements.
Well, you know there was this, during the Cold War, there was this expression in America, US, love it or leave it, right? So it's like a choice like that. So you are made a choice, leave it. I've said explicitly in many instances that this is the choice which I deny. I'm not watering down. You see as either or, and you repeated this expression, the only possible salvation. I don't believe it's an interesting point.
I always say so.
If Bloor and Barnes precisely have been criticized by me so fiercely, it's precisely because they are maintaining sociology of science in the shackles of a social explanation, and they never got out of it. That's why I criticize them. Now, if you say we should agree with one another, show me a scientific field which agree, where the practitioners agree with one another.
It's not that they disagree, that they don't understand you according to, you criticize us for not understanding you. You see, they criticize you for being more constructivist than them.
But there's
you
no
criticize
instant.
Them for being more constructivist than you. There's a lack of understanding, not a question of disagreement.
There is no instant rationality.
I mean, rationality.
I mean it's hard to understand. I mean, you cannot go very, very fast on these things. I say very clearly that the either or is not very important.
Either what or what?
I mean,
I didn't understand. Either what
the
or?
The social explanation or the other one, which Jean kindly repeated again.
Right, but I want to emphasize, in our book, we don't accuse you of being a radical relativist. We criticize Barnes and Bloor for expressing ideas which seem to indicate a consistent relativism. We criticize you not for radical relativism, but for radical ambiguity. we take that third rule of method with Jean read and analyze it. Well, I mean, irrespective of what you say in the fourth rule of method, you're presumably asserting the third rule of method. So we analyze the third rule of method at great length, at two or three pages, and we give it five possible interpretations, two of which are statements that are true and trivial, two are interesting, radical, and manifestly false, and the fifth is interesting, non-trivial, true, but one that you presumably wouldn't agree with. So.
Well, I very much enjoyed Jean's direct, very forceful intervention. However, he set a very bad example that was, however, pre-planned. The only person who's allowed to speak at such length later is Steve Woolgar, if he's here, on the grounds that he also jointly authored a book with one of the people up here, namely Bruno. I don't think he is here, is he? Otherwise, it would be nice if people could keep their questions fairly brief, and if they would state their affiliation and name when they ask a question. I don't, however, young woman at the back, there. Both the microphones are converging at once.
My name's Abigail Lacombe. I come from...
Is it on?
Are you sure it's on? It doesn't sound... Is it switch? Maybe it wasn't always yours.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Right.
That's better.
My name's Abigail Lacombe. I come from Royal Holloway College in University of London, French department. And I thought it was interesting that Alain Sokal, often when Monsieur Latour had his overhead projections, took him as when he said, when he had an argument, no, took him as saying that he didn't agree with that, when he was saying this is one thing you could think, and then he showed how it was much more complex. And it seems to me that when in your book you're taking rule 4 and you're not looking at rule, you're taking rule three, you're not looking at rule four, you're doing a similar thing, you're taking part of an argument that is far more complex and which you can't understand in part. Just as a suggestion, because when you look at literary studies, you can't just take a quotation without reading the whole book, because you generally will completely misunderstand it.
Rule four is talking about social explanations of science, and Bruno criticizes some of his fellow sociologists of science, who he thinks are too social constructivist. But nevertheless, he is asserting rule three, and we want to know what does rule three mean. And I think Jean read it. It's radically ambiguous. It runs from nature's representation in the first half of the sentence to nature in the second half of the sentence, as if they were identical, and of course they're not. And so there are at least four different interpretations of what the sentence means, depending on how you repair the ambiguity.
Well, one other thing. So you can go on.
Well, I translate it from French, but it's as the settlement of a controversy is the cause of stability of society, we cannot use the state of society to explain why and how a controversy has been solved. The state of nature and the state of society are two symmetrical consequences of the action of researcher in order to enroll humans and non-humans. But I don't understand why the settlement of controversy is the cause of stability of society and why the state of nature and of society, they are not outcome of our action. I mean, they are not.
Well, the fact, I mean, Picasso had this sentence when a woman in the party said, "I don't understand, master, I don't understand what you did." And Picasso said, "Madame, ça n'a aucune importance." So, the fact that it's slightly more complicated than Sleeper's philosophy of science is not my fault. I mean, we are working full-time on what it is to be simultaneously at work in the laboratory practicing science, and yet, because of this work, producing autonomous facts of nature no one has made. We spent 25 years doing this work full-time. But the solution is not clear-cut, but the solution requires some thinking, that there is no instant rationality to pick it up, proves only that we did good work. The fact that you don't understand, Madame, ça n'est pas très intéressant.
But you know, I mean, that's...
I forgot to ask. No, one thing we didn't discuss, which is serious, which is what Alan just said, that is the distinction. He insists very much on the distinction between the question of epistemology, that is the representation of nature, and the question of ontology. And I agree this is a very important distinction. Now, I don't think it's the one I'm interested in. So when you say I'm edging out because I'm not doing this distinction, that's precisely the source of clarity I want to introduce in the distinction, in the subject. That is not making the distinction, which seems common sense, I agree, but common sense has never been a very good guide in science. Anyway, the one between epistemological question, human representation, and ontological question. I think something much more interesting than that is at work in the sciences, and that it's not paying justice to the difficulty of science to use over and over again this distinction, and to accuse those who don't make it of being confused. We are not confused. I'm not confused. My friend Rose and the others are. But that's another thing. But I'm making another one, which is the one I'm interested in, that is precisely the one just John cited, which is human and non-human. I don't think human and non-human association, the question of how many entities are non-human entities, not the social one, because that's a myth, the social construction. The number of non-human entities with which we share our collective life is a trivial question. And I don't think it's well accounted for by the distinction between representation and ontological question. And that the idea, the counter argument be always the notion of then you deny the existence of the objective world. I mean, what can I say?
Just to go back to your earlier point, I think it's an ad hominem argument and a red herring to imply that because we're physicists, we therefore think that philosophy of science should be simple, and that your work is necessarily more profound than other work in the philosophy of science just because it's more difficult to understand what's being said or that it's ambiguous. I mean, I think we have to discuss the ideas involved and not quarrel about who's in what profession.
Agree, but the question of ambiguity is also, see, you can see something ambiguous depending on the distinction you think is important. If you don't use the distinction ontology, epistemology, what looks to you fuzzy is accommodated and becomes very sharp, and that's precisely what I do. So the argument, again, saying that an argument is ambiguous is not enough. Ambiguous according to what differentiation? That's what I'm interested in.
Well, maybe, I don't know, but should we ask you to clarify what the third rule of method means? That, let me read it once more. Since the settlement of a controversy is the cause of nature's representation, not the consequence, we can never use the outcome, nature, to explain how and why a controversy has been settled. Now, if I understand what you're saying right now, you're trying to deny the distinction between nature's representation, that is, scientists' theories, and nature, the external world. Is that what you're trying to say?
I'm
not sure.
It's so simple, but I'm surprised that it's a subject of debate. Actually, we're not debating. Are we debating my book or the question of it? Well, anyway,
well,
it's like it's a completely common to scientific practice and to you, I'm sure, which is when you are engaged in the discussion, for instance, on the existence of, let's say, warm-blooded dinosaurs, if a scientist were stopping in the discussion and say, I've Nietzsche on my side, the dinosaurs are like that, they would stop being scientists. Right? You cannot, in addition to the scientific practice, showing evidences proving your point, invoke in addition something more, which would be nature out there. Because what is and are the dinosaur warm-blooded or cold-blooded? We know it now through the word of a scientist. It's a very simple
point. I don't understand. You invoke evidence about the way the external world is.
Yes, but that's precisely. That's my point, which is common sense. Here, I don't understand.
But then why the slippage between nature's representation in the first half of the sentence and nature in the second half? In the second half of the sentence, you say, we can never use the outcome, nature, to explain how and why a controversy has been settled. If you take that literally, you're saying that nature, that is the external world, is the outcome of scientists' negotiations, which seems at least a bizarre form of radical idealism.
It's radical and bizarre because by negotiation you sneak it perversely, immediately, fights under mere social construction among scientists, the biggest and the most hairy one, by beating its chest and winning over. Of course it's bizarre, but if you say, which is exactly what I said, you use evidence, you present slides, you present footprints, which is a very big question of the footprints in this question, and you are not allowed to jump out like the Pope and say, in addition to all the evidence that I have, I also have nature on my side. No scientist in his good sense will do it, although the Pope recently did it for something different. So what the point is, if you suspend the argument for 1 minute, is now, okay, you have all this evidence. We wait outside, we the little guy, the one who are not paleontologists, and we are going to be told what nature is like after the paleontological meeting, not before the paleontological meeting. Now, the reason why you don't understand that or find that trivial or offensive is because you think there is a substitution.
I find it trivial.
Well, yeah. Or offensive because it's social construction.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I think if you have one of your five interpretations trivial, I think I would prefer.
Right.
Because I think it's complete common sense. Right. Sense.
But I still haven't understood what you mean by nature. You're saying that nature is the outcome of the settlement of a scientific controversy.
Yes.
Very strange.
No, because because there is no other way. I mean, then, see, the problem is that you believe it's a question of representation. But if you now get, don't forget, the whole of science studies is about the study of practice. That is, we would be interested in paleontologists, we would be interested in footprints, in casts, in the whole collection, in the expedition, which are able to maintain these evidences. So once you have all the evidence arrayed, then you get everything you need to know about paleontology. You don't need to add this extra assumption, which is an outsiderness, which is an addition to all these evidences. Now, your question is really like asking a Darwinian, okay, there are all of these things about genes, there is all this thing about evolution, but what about the outside soul? There is no outside soul in Darwinism, and there is no outside soul in mind science studies. I'm sorry. You don't need an addition.
Why are we talking about soul? I thought we were talking about an external world.
Well, because no, that's the trick. See, you make the exterior play two different roles. One of them is to be the arbiter of decision about science. No, you don't.
No,
are you
or what? The
external is an addition. Take my paleontologist meeting. Sorry, I have to take my.
I'm getting really worried.
Yeah.
Do we have time for that?
Of course, no, please.
Yeah.
Take my paleontological meeting. They know there is no superior arbiter to their dispute. Right now, while they are discussing, right? Once it's stabilized, once everyone of the scientific community, given the evidence which have been presented, will have focused and zeroed on the warm-blooded dinosaur, this will be an entirely different matter.
Why?
Do we agree on that?
No.
Science in action?
No.
But because the whole regime...
No, both...
That's what you get if you abolish the distinction between epistemology and ontology.
Right, right, right.
Well,
your confusion is self-inflicted. You cannot abolish the distinction between what we know about fact and what the objective reality is.
Well, it seems that all the scientists...
You get into the mud again.
So why would you go? Why do you go to an expedition in China in order to get prints? You are mixed. Well, that's what I say.
The point is there are facts of the matter about dinosaurs, and those facts of the matter are what they are, irrespective of what we know about it, and irrespective of what scientists have agreed about it. Scientists can be objectively wrong.
Sure.
Right.
The example of continental drift goes completely against everything you're saying.
Can we?
Well, you didn't.
Maybe one take more questions.
Yeah, I think let's. The gentleman just in front of you, yes. It was the guy in the blue suit is the one I had in mind, but never mind.
Editor of Nature. I was going to congratulate
you. Hold the microphone closer to your mouth, please.
Like that?
Yeah.
Okay. I was going to congratulate both speakers on their politeness to each other at the outset. But I do think that the issue deserves the heat that's now here. I'll give you an illustration. Last year I had to, most people, I avoid reading the avant-garde literature, except when I have to. And I had to last year because I undertook to review a book called Science in the 20th Century. Some of you may know it. Written by historians of science, with one practicing scientist among them, 20 or so contributors. And it was pure milk of radical relativism. So much so that in chapters on atomic theory, or in which the century has seen great advances, quantum mechanics and so on, there was a very distorted perspective of the development of the narrative. Indeed, there was often no narrative at all, simply a few declarations of principle. Now, it was put together by people representing, I guess, the majority of history of science schools in Europe, supported by the European Commission, and handsomely but overlavishly produced. It seems to me that we're in a bad way, the scientific profession. If history of science is going to be captured by radical relativism in the way typified in this book, and it raises the question, should the scientific profession actually set about doing its own history, not in the hagiographic way it used to, but in a much more realistic fashion than we're ever likely to get from people infected with the radical relativism you're talking about.
By the way, I would answer that no, or at least with reservations. I mean, it's correct to emphasize that historians and sociologists of science who want to analyze the content of science need a knowledge of the science they're studying that is essentially at a professional level. But I think it's also important to emphasize that an essentially professional knowledge of the historians trade is needed too. And the earlier history of science 50 years ago, when it was done by scientists, was frequently defective. And I think we need people who have the training, both as historians and scientists, and if they have that training, it doesn't matter what their formal degree is.
Bruno, do you want to say something about that?
I'm always worried by terms like infection, because I think we are getting into a very different conversation if we talk about plagues or infection. So I won't answer that.
Okay.
And I don't know the book anyway. So.
Okay, so the next person will remember to say who they are and where they're from, please.
Kenan Malik. Bruno Latour suggested that we shouldn't be frightened of relativism. But it seems to me that there is one form of relativism of which relativists are frightened, and that's this. All scientific knowledge is relative in relation to an objective reality. It's relative in relation to an objective reality because it is entirely provisional, likely to be superseded. But in order to understand scientific knowledge as relative in that fashion, you have to accept the notion of scientific progress, because without it, the notion of provisional scientific knowledge makes no sense. But most relativists are frightened of the notion of scientific progress because it seems to smack of ideas of teleology, of Whig history, and so on. And it seems to me that the irony of that is that what you set up is not knowledge of a picture of science and scientific knowledge as provisional, but a series of absolute knowledges of science, which you call paradigms, and a shift from one absolute understanding of nature to another. So it seems to me that the only reasonable way one can understand scientific knowledge as being relative in relation to objective reality is the one understanding of relativism that relativists themselves are frightened to accept.
Well, I have absolutely no difficulty with scientific progress, so I'm perfectly happy with scientific progress. And I'm very suspicious of Kuhn's solution to the problem of paradigm, because it's by far completely embedded into the opposition between representation and ontology, on which out of which he never managed to get. So Kuhn's solution, I don't think it's a very good solution, and I don't think it's actually vindicated by a lot of empirical work on what is a paradigm. A paradigm is a very, very tricky issue, and if someone is ambiguous, if there is one ambiguous notion, that's a notion of paradigm. Right. So again, I mean, your question is possible only inside the frame of representation. And don't forget, my argument is, on the contrary, for a more realistic definition of scientific practice. Once you have the evidence, once you let the non-humans get in the collective, you get plenty of realism, and not the moderate realism only. Because that's always the difficulty when you have the opposition between representation and ontology. You get in all the difficulty, which is, symbolized by the difficulty that Kant has. And I don't think that the end of philosophy is Kant. And Kuhn is just a historicizing version of Kant. So I don't think we make much progress. But on progress in science, I mean, absolutely no difficulty. Of course, we know more. And there are more non-humans produced and discovered and entered into a discussion and made to bear on our common collective than years ago. And I don't think, by the way, for the relativism argument, which is maybe one way of reopening the discussion which interests me more about multiculturalism, one way, just one little example which I find interesting, is that in this Amazon tribe that Alan has been talking about, the connection between nature and the culture is might be pursued as rather superficial, in the sense that the inner property of matter are not actually highly socialized. What interests me in modern society is that it's even more socialized. That is, when you get a very interesting gene, which is a copyright, which is made in order to maintain the copyright of soybean or maize inside the plant, you have more intimate connection between the social order and genetics. That's what I'm interested in. That's, I think, maybe one way of portraying the difference. You are interested in making sure that there is a clear distinction between outside reality, which is there as an arbiter, and the realm of social order. But that's not the thing I'm interested
but,
in.
But let me see if I understand what you said.
Because what I'm interested in is, on the contrary, in the intimate connection between social order and nature. And then I need different tools and different principles and different philosophy. That might be one other way of framing a disagreement, more productively, I hope.
But let me go back to what you said about 2 minutes ago. Are you saying that there's no distinction between dinosaurs and our theories about dinosaurs?
Yes, there is, of course. You mean theories?
You're admitting that there is a distinction. There is a distinction between dinosaurs and humans' theories about dinosaurs.
Yes, of course.
So
no, of course. Because what you mean is human representation made only with human tools. Of course they are. I mean, the dinosaur, if you want me to say that dinosaurs themselves are participating into the making of paleontology, the answer is yes, of course.
Right. So
more than you, because you have only the cut between representation of the dinosaurs out there. A dinosaur no one will ever see because it's a thing out there, invisible, arbiter, and unknown. My solution is that the dinosaurs is here, in the room, in the paleontologist meeting, mobilized for the instrument, mobilized for the evidence, assembled with the paleontologist, and you get all the outside reality you want. The only thing you don't get is this completely bizarre idea of an arbiter, which is pure thing in itself, no one sees, and yet you have to...
But that's your invention. That's your invention. We agreed that scientists don't invoke the dinosaurs, they invoke the evidence that they have about dinosaurs.
Yes, but that's all what I mean.
But let me try...
It's all what I mean.
Let's try one more example, see if we can understand not something that existed 65 million years ago, but something that exists now. In your book, you make fun of the... you talk about the debate about solar neutrinos and what is the solar neutrino flux, how many neutrinos are being emitted per second by the sun, and you make fun of the scientists who are trying to investigate this question experimentally. I mean, I could read the passage if you want, but what I want to know I'll read it if you want, but the question is there a distinction between the fact of the matter about the solar neutrinos and, well, first let me ask you, is there a fact of the matter of how many neutrinos are being emitted per second by the sun?
Yes.
Okay. Is there a distinction between that fact of the matter and scientists' beliefs about that matter?
That's an unnecessary hypothesis. And the best proof of that is the recent discovery, from what I understand, that neutrinos have a mass.
Why is that relevant?
Well, because the question is, if you want to explain the stage, the modification between what happened 10 years ago when I was writing this book and now, the question is, what are the tools which would be helpful for telling the story of that evolution?
I still haven't gotten an answer to the question. Is there a distinction between the fact of the matter of the number of neutrinos that are emitted per second by the sun and my belief or your belief or Jean's belief about that?
Well, yes, of course. My belief, certainly. And human belief...
Well, my belief, too.
And human belief in general, yes, of course. Because neutrino... The knowledge... If you want me to say that the knowledge of neutrino is made of human representation, the answer is no. The knowledge of neutrino is made of neutrinos.
What?
But neutrino...
No, now I'm really confused.
Well, that's of course... You're confused because you have only one alternative, which is either it's out there or...
I'm just trying to distinguish between the things that are out there and our beliefs about them.
It's a crucial
distinction, because unless you admit that distinction, then it's impossible for you to be wrong.
To be what?
To be wrong.
Wrong.
There's nothing out there that's different from the representation.
Maybe we should take what about the other question? Which was more productive, which is the question of the stronger and more realistic involvement that we have with things.
What do you mean by that? I haven't understood what you mean by it.
Well, because your should I say, your political philosophy is to insist very much and to make the shibboleth, if you want, the one that makes the difference is do you make a distinction between, I mean, the question you just asked. My shibboleth is very different, which is what sort of world we are going to live in, where we will have to share our polity, if you want, our political organization, our values, with more and more things, if you want. Although the word thing is not the exact word, to use my word, non-human. That's really my shibboleth. My question is, can you make any contribution to that? Well, non-humans, things which are not social constructed, if you want.
Well, can I translate that into, I think, what's clearer language? You're asking, how are we going to make our society and make public policy and so on in a world where there are increasingly many important scientific questions that are unresolved? Is that the question?
Yes, partly. Where especially...
I mean, that's an interesting question.
Where the appeal to the unity... No, that's the point. Where the appeal to the unity of nature, which is, I agree, okay, let's say it's out there, it's unified, does not make all the difference we want in order to be public order. That's what really I'm interested in.
Well, the appeal to the unity of nature certainly doesn't solve questions of public policy. I mean, the fact that there's one nature out there doesn't solve the question of where BSE comes from. It doesn't solve the question of how the Earth's climate works.
Well, that's one...
I mean...
But see, the whole...
Everyone knows that.
Of my, what you find confusing is that the whole tension of my argument and my, I agree, makeshift bricolage concept is aimed at understanding that question. And what it is to have a philosophy of science adjusted to this new word, which I call research, in order to call it, it's not a very good word, but to decode science and to code it with the difference between science and research. That is where...
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is basically in terms of political terms. As long as you are not going to stabilize or to quell or to quiet social disputes by appealing to the certainties of science. I think that's the real difference. When you are in the world of research, we are in the world of something which could be called collective experiment. That is, we are, I think the Swiss quotation, I'd like to have your comment on that. I mean,
I actually wanted to comment on it.
Sorry?
I did want to comment on
it. Okay, well, I'd be interested in it. Because that, I think, is a very new sign. It's a very, of course, the solution is very bad, the notion of majority rule in order to settle an issue about degenerative and progressive research problems is pretty bad. But I think it's a sign of a time where a lot of people are doing more than the question of values that you mentioned before. It's a question of research policy. Now, how do you handle that? How do you handle the multiplication of people having a say on research policy in the worst possible way, that is, majority rule?
But I think you've confused two questions, right? You said the Swiss decided on the difference between a progressive and degenerating research program in the sense of Lakatos. No, they didn't. They were not deciding a cognitive question about genetics. They were deciding a policy question about which experiments and which technologies were to be allowed. That's a very different question.
Well, that's precisely the point. Is it a different question?
Anyway, I think we should... there are lots of people wanting to ask questions, so let's... I think the first one I saw was Dylan down here. Are you still... Sorry? Oh, okay, yeah. There are people want to shout. Yeah. Oh, that was clever. Okay, let's have somebody from up there. Yes, please, on the front row, yes.
Shout.
You have to shout very loudly.
Eddie Marcus, postgraduate student at the University of North London. You said in your second talk that there were laws of nature outside of human experience, to roughly paraphrase you. Could you explain in cornflake packet mark, 12 words or less, what is a law of nature outside its representation of language?
Well, okay. There are certainly facts of nature independent of human experience. The universe presumably existed roughly 10 billion years before humans ever existed. That universe had properties, right? I don't care if you want to call those properties of nature or laws of nature, but the point is the universe did have properties before humans existed. I mean, in fact, we actually know something about those properties because we can make coherent theories of cosmology that explain the evidence and that explain the evolution of the universe long before humans existed. So what I was talking about was simply the properties of the universe that are independent of any human's representation of them.
being nice to the up people now.
Well, that's a very important question, of course, which will lead us to the one other core of the dispute, which is the definition of what we mean by modern society. And my definition of modern society is a society in which these mixtures and profound entanglement between, let's say, a laboratory, a company, field, farmers, and so on, is rampant. I mean, that's what I call a hybrid. I mean, the case of soybeans is a bad example. I mean, embryo, let's say. But it's very confusing mixtures of all of these things being made, and that's a large part of the mixture between industry, science, the state, and so on. And another process, which is completely different, that's why I would disagree, still disagree with you, which is to purify these mixtures by making it two different pots. One for fact and one for value. So I don't take the difference between fact and value as the intellectual resources we need. I think it's one of the results of a very complicated process of purification of things which have to be tackled differently. And I don't believe that, you might be right, of course, this is an open question. I don't say I'm right. You have to understand that all this philosophy of science, the sociology of science, is an experiment. It's trying to make sense of things. It's not so. It's completely. I might be completely wrong. Of course, we will discover that maybe later. Yes, he knows, but I'm already wrong. So, the discovery has been made, but not to me actually. And so, that's why I don't want to use the distinction between fact and value in order to understand these imbroglios, in which it's very complicated to know where the scientists stop. Saying it's desirable, it should be like this. If you look at the television, the Swiss television, on the reaction of a scientist appealing to pleading for the vote in Switzerland, the no vote was for let's go on with the research, and the yes vote was let's stop it. Right? I must say that the type of argument that scientists use in order to pursue the research were pitiful. So they were extremely bad at arguing their point, and if they won I'm sorry to say that, but a large question of them, unfortunately, the money spent by Nestlé and the others, because if it had relied only on the scientist's argument to re-argue their case, and I think they had a very good case, and they could have argued it, it was pitiful. And I think part of that is this very, very distinction between fact and value, which is not necessarily operational for the task which we are doing now. Now, I agree, this is a risky decision to abandon the difference between fact and value.
It's on this question, John, is it directly? Yeah. Can you take the mic low, please? Just down there. Make sure it's on.
Is it on?
Yes.
In answer to your answer to his original question, I would say that if you mix oil and water, you do not thereby break down the distinction between oil and water. You're saying that we've got all these entanglements, but entanglements don't cause any breakdown of fundamental distinctions.
But that's not what I said. I said the difference between values and fact is a later purification of a site on embryo, which is defining the modernist ethos. So that's an argument about what it is to be a modern society. To be in a modern society is basically, and I think that might be why sometimes postmodernism is used by Alan. I think we need a clear distinction between what is a a modernist and postmodernist, which doesn't mean much, but a modernist is someone who really believes that next year, or at least in the next century, or in the future, there will be a clear difference between facts and values. That is, the distinction will be clearer so that we could make a clearer difference between what is the representation by humans and what things are like. And I think that's a nice shibboleth to make the distinction. So postmodernism has lots of defects, but the timing is different. The feeling that the time flows is slightly different. And I think this notion of different feeling of time explains a lot of the disagreement, of a false disagreement, or false agreement that we have in this discussion.
Well, I don't think it's a false disagreement.
Disagreement.
We're insisting on the analytical importance of the distinction between the way the world is and our beliefs about the world. That doesn't mean that in any particular case we can be certain about the way the world is and know for certainty whether our beliefs accord or don't with the way the world is. But it's analytically crucial to distinguish between facts of nature and our beliefs about them. If you don't make that distinction, then it's not possible for you to be wrong. And it's crucial. I mean, I think this has importance that goes far beyond the questions of science studies or philosophy of science. I think it's a crucial question for pedagogy. If you want to inculcate a critical spirit in students, you want them to question both their own beliefs and other people's beliefs. And a crucial element of that is remembering that one can be wrong, that the truth or falsity of one's beliefs is judged by its accordance or lack of accordance with external realities.
But that I don't disagree. Of course, there are many ways of being wrong. I mean, if you don't have the fact with you and the evidences, you're wrong. I mean, it's quite simple. I never disagree with that.
Okay, that's good.
I think there's a difference. Can I just ask one more question to Alan to see if we make some progress? It's not the same to say you insist on an analytical category and I am confused, or to say you insist on an analytical category and I'm insisting on another analytical category, which from the task which I propose to philosophy of science is different. In other words, you constantly appropriate analytical clarity with the set of distinctions which I deny are useful. I'm making another set of analytical, and I don't think you have a right to say this is just confused, which means that I'm in another task. I just want this set of codicils to be introduced.
But I think I have the right to ask you whether you... I mean, you can make any distinctions you want, or you can talk about the usefulness of distinctions, but I think I have the right to ask you whether you do or do not admit the distinction between dinosaurs and humans' beliefs about dinosaurs.
Well, precisely, if we want to be maintained the difference between, to take again this example, and the right and the possibility of being wrong, the allusion to the outside dinosaurs is absolutely of no use. Now, the one bringing new evidence, that's what makes you wrong or right.
But wait a minute.
That's a very important
what is the evidence of?
Sorry?
I haven't understood. What is the evidence of?
Well, evidence of the dinosaurs, of course.
I think.
But then.
But not the outside unknown dinosaurs, which is there as a referee and arbiter. No, it's the prime of Kant. It's the prime of things in themselves, which is a useless problem. Why do we discuss that?
You can have the evidence in your favor and yet be wrong. Because the evidence may be insufficient.
Yes, well, you have a. Fortunately, you have colleagues.
There are lots of people who want to speak, and we're getting very close to the witching hour. I think the next person, actually, it's a long time ago, but I think Craig is the next person, and then some people. So right at the back there, and then the gentleman in front, and then there are some. No, it's behind you. Then you're next.
Sorry. Craig Callender. I'm a lecturer in the philosophy department here. And I'm also a amateur collector of fossils, so I'd like to come to the defense of both the philosophy of science and dinosaurs. Now, I mean, I think one of the things that's disturbing about this debate is the lack of the number of distinctions that are often made in philosophy of science and that have been made for I don't know, at least 100 years or so. So we constantly see the distinction between the various concepts being run over. For instance, in Professor Latour's talk, you can see the distinction between realism and realistic, which are clearly two very different concepts being blurred together. But I want to, and what I wanted to say was that there is one, well, it seems to me that as soon as you blur the distinction between ontology and epistemology, then in fact you do end up going down the slippery slope to the radical sort of form of relativism that Professor Latour doesn't want to be committed to. And one often sees a sort of mistake in the literature and sociology of science in confusing what it means to be objective and non-objective. One sees this in, for instance, in Stanley Fish's defense of sociology of science from Sokol's hoax in the New York Times a year or two ago. Fish says, well, of course sociologists of science aren't relativists. We're not radical relativists at all. We think that there are lots of objective things and that they can be socially constructed. And then other people think, well, they can't be, that you know, if something is objective, it can't be socially constructed. But that's not quite right either. What is true, and Fish points out that, you know, they take balls and strikes in baseball. He said balls and strikes in baseball are objective. It's an objective fact of the matter on a given pitch, whether something's a ball or a strike. Yet balls and strikes are are a socially constructed category. So you can agree with that, but still, dinosaurs aren't like balls and strikes, and neither are electrons, and that's the distinction that's being slid over again and again.
I have nothing to say about Fish except this, I think it's an English proverb, save me of my friends and I will take it in my hand.
Gentleman in front there, microphone's just behind you, and then, well then I'm going back up there, and then the lady in front of you.
Yes. Latour just said that perhaps we'll go forward or we'll make some progress when he was talking with his colleague, Sokal. I'm very happy that finally you're not talking about books and you are just talking about your positions in the philosophy of science and in the scientific concept. But what I'm going to say is about art and music. All the terminologies that you used, of course, about the unity of the world, of the society and science, it is inherent also in art and music. I mean, I am personally a performer of music and a researcher of music and an artist. I have just finished my research on Turner and music for Oxford University Press. What I am interested to know from both of you, does science of music or the musician or the science of art and the art give you some inkling about the fundamental, let's say, dispute that you have? Because without paintings, we cannot have any research about paintings. Without music itself, any research about music is useless. But both are fundamental and it is very necessary. But what is it that in science you are mentioning about the war in science, as if the social scientists have the envy of physics, as it is mentioned usually, and this is a very awkward situation. I don't think it's a very obscene situation, because in the field of art, no matter how much they are arguing, that kind of war, it is not formulated as such, and I'm interested to see if music and art will give you some inkling about the unity of the world, how to arrive to that unity.
Now, both people want to talk about science, not about other things, I suppose. Can we then move on? I think there was one more question up at the top and one at the bottom, and then we must finish. Young woman there, please. Michelle?
I don't know. I have to get the bottom. Overview, and see if we understand. There's the natural world that is out there, and then there is science trying to uncover, if you would, or unveil, or create
creation of fact, whatever you want to call it, to what the representations are or what we know about it. And then there's what I think I understand Bruno is trying to do, which is take it one step further and understand how all of this reality is being integrated into society and how we're using it. I don't know if I've seen this wrongly, but I think the only problem I have is that we don't have a perfect understanding of the natural world because we're not perfect scientists. And so but I still think it's just equally as valid to try and understand what our imperfect understanding of the natural world is in society, and that might be more meaningful than quibbling whether we have the reality or we don't have the reality, because that sort of wheel of science is continuously going on, and how much is socially constructed and how much is real fact based on evidence, there's a mixture of the two. So rather than continuously arguing that, we should maybe go ahead and take what we have and try and go further, and with the realization that there is some social input into what we see as reality, and also with just the acceptance or faith that there is some kind of natural reality outside that we don't have any grasp on clearly, tangibly, only through our evidence.
But you see, I want to go further. I admit that scientists' theories contain a mixture of true statements about the external world and errors, and that sometimes the errors are caused by social prejudices. But I want to know, okay, how can we pursue the process of filtering those theories so that they come closer and closer to accurate representations of the external world? I mean, that is the task of science, I think. And I think the sociologist here can be helpful in that. I think an adequate philosophy of science does have a social element, because science is carried out by humans, and there are some social situations that make science more or less likely to get truths about the world or make mistakes. And I think it is useful for sociologists and historians to investigate that.
I think, with apologies to everybody else who wants to ask questions, which somehow the number of people who want to ask questions increased steadily over time, which I think is a good reflection on how interesting the talk's been. But I think we now ought to move towards a closure. So I'll ask each of the speakers if they'd like to just sum up in a couple of minutes. If not, then...
I'm willing to let people have more questions rather than as people want.
Helena, what do you think? Is not good?
Because Bruno and I have talked a lot. Maybe we should let some other people talk.
The boss says we've got five more minutes, but we definitely do finish. Let's go to a person right at the back, next to John Maynard Smith. We have to shout very loud.
You all shall hear is to Bruno Latour. Bruno, in a way, I think if you'd make your ideas more sexy for the audience, if what you did instead is talk about the objectivity of hybrids, yeah? What you're telling us about the contemporary world is that there are these hybrids, laboratories and companies and fields and things. And that's probably more interesting for us who are the kind of people who are doing this kind of research, you know, in the social world, in the world itself. So don't be shy about it. Tell people about hybrids instead.
Am I shy?
I don't think you need to be sexier when you've got a French accent, actually, not in England. There's a young woman who's been waiting a long time down there. Sorry, I forgot about her. Can you wait for the microphone, though, please? It's coming here. No, there it is.
Hello? Get close. My name is Marina Benjamin. I'm a writer and journalist, but I studied history of science a long time ago now. And my question is primarily addressed to you, Mr. Sokol. Which is that I... Okay. Close.
Okay.
Louder.
We're very close.
No, I have a question. Can you just let me frame my thought? I've been waiting for a long time to ask it. The question I want to know is why you seem to me to be treating this breakdown between epistemology and ontology as if maintaining such a breakdown was an epistemic position. It could be a descriptive position, in which case it would bear a similar relationship to what you do as scientists, as the work that you produce bears to nature. In other words, it's a very useful way of talking about what it is that you do. And I don't really understand your problem with this breakdown.
I'm not sure if I've understood your question. No, I mean seriously, try to rephrase it.
In all the discussions that have been going on in the last hour or so, the breakdown of the distinction between epistemology and ontology is being given the status of an epistemic statement.
I'm sorry, the breakdown meaning the fact that Bruno wants to blur the distinction. Is that what you mean by
yes.
the breakdown?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a descriptive statement. It's not an epistemic statement. It's not an it's not saying what there is in the world. It's descriptive.
Descriptive of what? Descriptive of sociologists. I mean, I'm still not sure.
It's a descriptive way of describing what scientists do in the world.
The breakdown.
In the same way yeah. that science is descriptive of the so-called world out there. It bears the same relationship to what you do as scientists as your science does to the world out there. Therefore, it is something that you shouldn't be against. I don't understand why you're opposing it.
Opposing blurring the distinction between dinosaurs and beliefs about dinosaurs.
Yes, as a descriptive tool.
Well, it may be that the blurring of the distinction between dinosaurs and the belief in dinosaurs is an accurate description of some people's sociologists' state of mind.
I think you're cheating.
But no, I really don't understand the question.
Okay. Behaving as though the dinosaurs are outside and your belief in dinosaurs is inside. I have understood Mr. Latour to be saying that both the dinosaurs and the beliefs about it are inside.
What is this house with inside and outside it? I mean, I just don't know.
It's
a metaphor for something, but I don't know what it's a metaphor for.
Okay, nature is outside, and I have understood Mr. Latour to be saying that the dinosaurs that you are saying are outside the house are in fact inside.
But I still don't understand what this house is.
Okay, I think we should not live on that. I think maybe the time has come now to draw things to a close. I think Bruno would like to say a couple of words in just a minute in a final remark.
Well, maybe just to follow up on that, it's interesting that the way Alan rephrased my position was dinosaurs and belief in dinosaurs. When I say evidences about dinosaurs, proofs, documents, fossils, and the dinosaurs out there, which is the Kantian thing in itself. So you ridicule, so to speak, not willingly, but at least unwillingly, my position by shifting precisely what was the core of the argument.
No, I'm confused about what you actually are saying, because we agree that scientists can only invoke evidence.
Well, okay, that's the point. So So what are we supposed to do?
You aren't supposed to do anything. You have a minute or so to start to some final remarks if you'd like. Otherwise, we'll thank you very much. And
well, then, I thank you very much.
Well, I do. Thanks. I do think it's a great tribute to the speakers and to the interest of the topic that so many of you stayed around, especially so many people standing up for well over 2 hours now. And I would like to thank both speakers. It's a tradition of this Darwin at LSE to present mementos of the occasion.
a dinosaur.
To the two speakers, and apparently, it's over the top to the chairman, but I can't present anything to myself, so...
I get a copy of Bruno's book.
This is probably a copy of Bruno's book. And this is probably a copy of Alan's book. And,
Maybe you could swap it and admire it. Well, thank you very much.